me to tell. Now, I know that boy ain't done nothing like that. And hard as you working, trying to send him to school. And so it went. If the father had ever intended on sending him back, he now had a publicly acceptable excuse for not doing so, and he had come out the hero in the deal. As for little George, no colleges near Eustis, nor any state universities in Florida, for that matter, admitted colored students. The closest colored colleges were hours away. He had a wife to support now, so he would have to do precisely what his father had intended all along. It looked as if he might never make it back to school, and he would have to live with vows made in anger for the rest of his life. It would not be happy, because he knew and she knew how it had come to be. But they would both try to make the best of it, now that the deed was done. Robert Joseph Pershing Foster, Los Angeles, 1996. The paneled door rises a story high and would befit a museum or government office, but is actually the front door of a Spanish revival south of Wilshire. The door opens, and there stands a one-time bourbon-swilling army captain and deft-handed surgeon, who now in his later years is a regular at the blackjack tables and the trifectas at Santa Anita. But he is at the heart of it all, and perhaps most important, a long-standing, still bitter, and somewhat obsessive expatriate from the 20th century South. The heartbreak Jim Crow land he chose to reject before it could reject him again. He is a Californian now, this Robert Joseph Pershing Foster. He is the color of strong coffee and has waves in his hair, which he lets grow as untamed as Einstein's, but then brushes back like the boys in the band. He's wearing a white cotton island shirt, loose slacks and sandals, the uniform of the well-to-do L.A. pensioner. He has the build and bearing of a Sammy Davis Jr., and not a little of the showmanship and delightful superficiality that seem to grow on people in certain circles of L.A. He walks straight-backed and slew-footed into the foyer, past the curved, faux, gone-with-the-wind staircase, and the East Asian pottery. He gestures toward the living room, an imposing museum of a space that dwarfs him in its volume, fairly frozen in the seafoam carpet and hot pink tulip chairs out of a sherbety Doris Day movie from the 50s. The whole effect is as starched and formal as the tuxedos he used to wear to the parties he threw for himself back when his wife Alice was alive and the money was raining down like confetti. He seems accustomed to people fawning over the place, and with the prim air of leading men of his favorite movies from back in the 40s, insists on serving his guests a slice of lemon pound cake and vanilla ice cream on Rosenthal china, whether they would like to have it or not. His heavy-lidded eyes look straight into those of his listener, and have a distractingly thick fringe of lashes, like those seen on babies and starlets. He is a physician, or was for most of his adult life, and by most accounts a very good one, and is prone to pontificate like a man of his years and accomplishments. But he is just as likely to interrupt himself and check the time to see if he can still make the 1 o'clock at the Hollywood Park racetrack. His photo albums are filled with an unlikely assortment of bookies and blues singers, and dentists and fraternity men, and surgeons and society people, whose approval he craved, even though he knew they were too pretentious to matter, really. He doesn't say it because it would be gauche and hardly worth mentioning from his point of view, but there happen to be a lot of little Roberts around town, due to the fact that over the years he delivered a number of baby boys whose mothers were so grateful for his firm hand and calming reassurances at the precise moment of truth that they named their sons not after their husbands, but after the doctor who delivered their babies. Before he begins his story, he tells you it's a long one and you can't get it all. He's lived too many lives, done too much, known too many people, ridden so high and so low, that there's no point in fooling yourself into thinking you can capture the whole of it. You could try, of course. And he agrees to give as much as he can. I love to talk, he says, a smile forming on his still chiseled face as he sits upright in his tulip chair. And I am my favorite subject. Monroe, Louisiana, 1933. It was a Saturday. Pershing Foster, the teenage son of ambitious but barely paid schoolteachers, began to stir in the thin light of morning. He lived across the railroad tracks from the rest of Monroe, in the worn, colored section mockingly known as Newtown, despite its dirt roads and old shotgun houses on stilts. He pulled out his good pants with the 3-inch waistband and the buttons on the side. A few hours from now, the Paramount Theater would go dark, and Gene Harlow or Errol Flynn or some other airbrushed and porcelain movie star would appear out of nowhere, big as a building. Pershing wanted to be there when the curtain went up and escape his segregated cell of a life, if only for 94 minutes. But his father reminded him he couldn't leave just yet. The cows had to be brought in from the grazing pasture and milked before he could go. Morning after morning, his father had tried to teach him how to milk. Each time, Pershing bent down and pulled hard on the teats, but he could never get the hang of it, nor, truth be told, really wanted to. One time, the cow kicked over the bucket, and the milk spilled everywhere, which only proved to Pershing, who didn't want to be there in the first place, that he wasn't cut out for this line of work. "I told you that cow didn't like me," Pershing said. His father couldn't afford to lose a whole bucket of milk. Madison Foster was the principal of the colored high school, a misnomer because it included every grade from the first through the 11th, but in any case, paid him a fraction of what the state openly and unapologetically paid his white counterparts, and left him and his family only slightly better off than the colored servants in town. He needed that milk to supplement his wages, and he didn't have milk to waste. "Let him go," his father finally conceded to his wife, Audie. "Unloose him. Unloose him." Pershing got his way. He was the last child Audie would ever bear, and to the degree that a colored child could be spoiled when so much of the world was cut off to him, he was. There were three children above him. Madison was the oldest and away most of the time, off in medical school. He was going to be the first doctor in the family, as Audie, who set her sights higher than the teacher that she was, liked to say of her firstborn. Leland, the second son, was a star pitcher at Morehouse College in Atlanta. His parents had big plans for Leland, naming him as they did after their alma mater, Leland College in New Orleans. People were saying Leland had a shot at the Negro Leagues. He had to fight the girls off him as it was. He had a sculpted mahogany face and waves in his hair. He had the best mind of all the four children, but to his mother's great sorrow was a regular at the pool hall and the juke joints, despite her best efforts. The women called him Woo, which is what they whispered when they saw him. There was a sister named Emlyn. They called her Gold, owing to the sunset cast to her skin, and her place as the only surviving girl. Her twin, Evelyn, had died as an infant. Everybody fussed over Gold and told her how beautiful she was, which she was. The table seemed set before Pershing was ever born, and he couldn't see how to stand out on his own or figure out how he fit in as the youngest. A few years before, when he was about 10, he hit upon something that he thought he could do. He was in fifth grade, and when the school bell rang, he ran to meet his mother in her seventh grade classroom. He told her his discovery as they walked home together. "Mama, I believe I can play the piano."
"You think you can?"
"Yes, Mama, I know I can."
"What makes you know?"
"Mama, all you got to do is do like this," he said, banging his fingers on an invisible keyboard as he walked, "and hum the song, and it'll come out."
"You think so, baby?"
"Yes, Mama."
"Well, Tomorrow after school, you go down and you try it on the piano and you let me know how you come out. The next day, he did as she said. Noise came out of the piano instead of the music in his head, and that was the end of his short career as a pianist. He never spoke of it again, and seeing that he didn't bring it up, neither did his mother. The day the cow kicked over the bucket, they let Pershing have his way. He was a teenager now, and off to the Paramount. It sat gaudy and beautiful on the other side of the Missouri Pacific Railway tracks from the colored section of town. He stepped out of the white frame bungalow with his pants creased to a knife edge, the crinkled waves in his hair pomaded and patted down, and proceeded down the dirt roads leading downtown. He went past the little plank houses that stood on cinder blocks due to the rains and floods, and jumped over the dirt ditches that made grass islands of every yard around. He picked up paper shell pecans that fell in people's yards, like litter. Soon he came to the places where the white people lived. The streets were paved and smooth now. In Newtown, the roads were earthen humps with a ditch on either side to catch the bayou when it ran out of places to go. Whenever it rained, the streets turned to mud, and Pershing and the other children jumped in the ditches and splashed around as if the ditches were a swimming pool. They didn't know what a real pool was like, because the only one in town didn't allow children who looked like them. Trucks rumbled down the road and flung dust on the porches and through the screens and into the front rooms of the houses on Pershing's side of town. The mud and dust were an affront to Pershing, and he defied it the best he could. He made a game out of proving he could outwit his lower caste world. "It was my personal pride to wait till a rainy day and polish my black and white shoes," he said, "and wear them when the rain had stopped and jump over puddles and not get a spot of anything on them." Those dirt roads were the reason he never learned to skate, and he could never forget that. "We could buy skates," Pershing would remember, even as an old man, "but we couldn't buy sidewalks." Downtown was called Five Points, the intersection of 18th and Desaird, and when Pershing got there, he walked further down Desaird Street past Piccadilly's restaurant, where the white people ate, and on to the Paramount straight ahead. He could see the double glass doors in front and a crowd forming outside. He knew to ignore the front entrance. It was off limits to people like him. He went to get his ticket. It was a more complicated affair than it had to be, owing to the whims and peculiarities of how Jim Crow played out in a particular town or establishment. For a time, there was a single ticket agent working both booths, the window for the colored and the one for the white. The agent swiveled between the two openings to sell the movie tickets, a roll to the white line, and then a pivot to the colored. It created unnecessary confusion and waiting time for one line or the other, the waiting borne more likely by the colored moviegoers than the white, as waiting to be served after colored people would have been unacceptable to the white clientele. By the time Pershing was nearly grown, the swiveling ticket agent was dispensed with in favor of altogether separate windows and ticket sellers, which would cost a little more, but would move the white and colored lines along more quickly, and was more in keeping with the usual protocols of Jim Crow. The Paramount fancied itself like one of the great opera houses of Europe, with its crimson velvet curtains and pipe organ rising from the orchestra pit. A double wide staircase ushered theatergoers to its box seats. But Pershing would not be permitted near them. He followed the colored crowd to the little door at the side entrance, while the white people passed through the heavy glass doors on Desaird. He saw Jimmy and Clarence and Nimrod and just about every other kid from Newtown on his way in. The side door opened onto a dark stairway. Pershing mounted the steps, anxious to get a seat before the lights went dim. He went up one flight, two flights, three, four, five flights of stairs. The scent of urine told him he was getting closer to the colored seats. At the top of the stairs, There was Benny Anderson, the colored ticket taker, ready to take his stub. The urine aroma was thick and heavy now. The toilet was stopped up most of the time, and the people did what they had to. Some relieved themselves on the way up. Pershing thought they did it on purpose, a protest, maybe, for the condition of the place, not registering that it was other colored people who had to suffer for it. He could understand it, but he didn't much approve. Pershing sat hard in the wooden seat and tried not to notice the stuffed upholstery on the main floor below. Sometimes the kids would rain popcorn and soda pop on the white people. At last, the place went dark, and Pershing left Monroe. He was on a bright veranda with Myrna Loy and Tyrone Power out in California. It was a perfect world, and he could see himself in it. The only way that someone as proud and particular as Pershing could survive in the time and place he was in was to put his mind somewhere else. He grew up watching his parents exercise exquisite control over the few things they were permitted to preside over in life. Their domain was the Monroe Colored High School, where Madison was principal and Audie taught seventh grade. It was a small brick building with 1,139 pupils and a teacher for each grade, from kindergarten to 11th, and run with the precision of a military institution. Madison James Foster was a short man, partial to vested suits and Bible scripture. He had had a hard, orphan-like childhood, which he kept to himself, other than to say that he had been raised not by his parents, but by white people in New Iberia, down by the Gulf. As a boy in the 1880s, he showed a gift for reciting verse, and his white guardians had him perform for their guests as parlor entertainment. There he stood in the middle of a Victorian front room, white guests gathered around him, and was told to recite scripture for their amusement. They saw that he had a facile mind, and when the time came, offered him some assistance to get a degree. He landed at an old colored school called Leland College in New Orleans, where he met a preacher's daughter named Audie. They graduated from Leland in 1905 and married the same year. They had big plans for themselves, just as Jim Crow was closing doors on them. They set out to teach far from New Orleans, in a moated land of cotton gins and oak trees, dripping plant feathers between the Ouachita River and the bayou. An opportunity had arisen in Monroe, an old mill town near the upper brim of the Louisiana Boot, not far from where the shoelaces would be. Monroe was three counties west of Mississippi, 75 miles from Vicksburg. It was closer to the cotton fields of the Delta than the bon temps rolling high life of New Orleans, where the two of them had met. To the north was the tenant farming Ozark land of Warm Springs and Hard Living in Arkansas, where an attempt by sharecroppers to unionize in the town of Elaine would be crushed with bloody efficiency in 1919. To the west was Texas, the wide-open grazing and cotton land of vigilante justice and lynching spectacles that drew people by the thousands and made the newspapers all over the country. In the midst of this violence, Monroe was a quietly hierarchical town, with its two castes remaining in their places and separated by two sets of railroad tracks. The town had been founded by French traders in the 19th century and became a mill town serving the nearby cotton plantations and lumber concerns by the time the Fosters got there. The town came into its own in the 1920s with the arrival of a crop dusting outfit out of Macon, Georgia, the company having decided to move to the more strategically located town of Monroe, closer to the Mississippi Delta. In 1928, a businessman named C.E. Woolman purchased what was then known as Huff DeLand Dusters. He switched from crop dusting and began running the first passenger flights between Mississippi and Texas via Monroe and Shreveport in 1929. The company would later come to be known as Delta Airlines, named after the region it originally served. Delta's presence in Monroe was little more than a distant point of pride to the colored people there, as they could not have become pilots, stewardesses, or gate agents for the airline, and might glean only the ancillary benefits of cleaning the airport and serving the now wealthier and well-positioned white people working there. Delta would remain headquartered in Monroe until 1941, when it relocated to Atlanta with the United States' entry into World War II. It was in Monroe that Madison and Audie Foster spent their honeymoon, hoping to prosper despite the limits of their era, a time when Jim Crow was closing in on them and mutating all over the South. Madison took a position as principal, and she as a teacher of the colored children who spilled out of the shotgun houses on the colored side of the Kansas City Southern and Union Pacific Railroad tracks. They eventually bought a white frame bungalow on Louise Ann Avenue, surrounded by icemen, barbers, sawmill workers, and domestics. The colored people took to calling the husband Professor Foster, out of an overinflated respect for his bachelor's degree and the position he held over them. It came out Fessa Foster, though, by the time people got through saying it. He cut a tight-buttoned bearing in his Kuppenheimer suits and arrow shirts with detachable white collars and cufflinks, always gold cufflinks. By the late 20s, he was in a position of some prestige among colored people in town, the president of the Louisiana Colored Teachers Association, and was regularly mentioned in the Louisiana News section of the Chicago Defender for attending or speaking at some important colored meeting or convention. He rose early to open his school and greeted the people on their porches as he passed. He had authority of some sort over practically every child in Newtown. Some Sundays, he preached at Zion Traveler Baptist Church. It was a world unto itself. The striving colored people in town stooped and trodden the rest of the week, invested their very beings into the church, and quarreled over how things should be run and who should be in charge of the one thing they had total control over. In the summer of 1932, the church actually split into two rival factions as to who should be the pastor. One side was backing the Reverend W.W. Hill, an old-school preacher who had just been ousted. The other was supporting Professor Foster, a starched man with a standoffish wife and brilliant children, whom some people saw as having enough influence as it was, seeing as how he already ran the school. The church grew so divided that people were no longer speaking. Enemy lines were drawn. The church had to shut down for 2 whole months. The authorities in Monroe took away the keys. The church reopened the first Sunday in September 1932, along with the wounds and hostilities that were no closer to healing than the day the church was shuttered. That morning, Sunday school had barely begun, when there arose a contention between the two factions as to who was in charge of the church, the Chicago Defender reported. There was a question as to whether the apparent victor, Professor Foster, should speak, the Hill people saying it was perhaps best that he not, the anti-Hill faction urging him to go forward. Professor Foster was accustomed to running things. He arose and stood stiff and pious and was reading Bible scripture, when 4 women walked up to the pulpit and demanded he stop preaching, as if to suggest he had no right to be taking over as he had. It was an outrageous, unheard-of disruption, practically blasphemous, and the church broke into an uproar. Several men rushed the pulpit and began fighting. A deacon backed out of the door, hitting back at those who pursued him and falling down in the street. A parishioner named James Dugans, who was either a supporter of Professor Foster or merely enraged at the show of disrespect, picked up a chair, drew a pistol, and started shooting. A bullet struck a woman named Patsy Daniels in the stomach. Incensed, her father ran to a house next door and got a pistol of his own. The father came back to a fight that had now spilled out to the front of the church. When the first gunman, Dugans, saw the woman's now armed father, he shot him in the chest. The bleeding father continued firing as he fell, killing Dugans and wounding 3 other parishioners. Patsy Daniels died from her wounds. In all, as many as 7 people were left wounded, including the dead woman's father. Professor Foster and his family managed to escape unharmed, physically in any case. The Monroe police again had to take the keys of the church. Until the congregation could settle its dispute, the doors of the church were securely nailed up, the Atlanta Daily World reported. Pershing was 13. He would now end up seeing the world as a beleaguered and unappreciated Foster, a member of a resented clan in a small clannish subculture inside a segregated pressure cooker of a life. The incident was so unseemly and beneath him that he never spoke of it. But he carried the sense of betrayal and insecurity with him, and in some ways would spend the rest of his life both running from those who rejected his family and craving their acceptance. After the melee, neither Reverend Hill nor Professor Foster would ever muster the full support of the congregation or get to run Zion Traveler Baptist Church. In time, life somehow returned to some version of normalcy, and Professor Foster instead took comfort in his place as the leading black educator in town. On school mornings, he stood at the front steps of the school with a pocket watch in one hand and a paddle in the other. Sometimes the students came running across the schoolyard late and out of breath. "The train's cut us off, Professor Foster," the children would tell him. "I'm going to cut you off," he'd say, raising his paddle. "Get up early, get up early." He held chapel before class started, quoting the Old Testament in the auditorium for an hour every morning, and he believed in sparing neither the rod, paddle, or switch. He half waited for some child to get out of line so he could make an example out of him. But as anybody who grew up in that world could tell you, he was no better or no worse than any colored schoolmaster in the South when it came to such things. His wife, Audie Alberta Wright Foster, was a prim and ambitious woman who made the society pages of the colored papers as president of the Golden Seal Embroidery Club, and for hosting such things as a wedding breakfast for a bridal party in what the defender called a lovely home, prettily decorated for the occasion. Audie was raised in New Orleans, a magic circus of a place compared to Monroe, braided with openly mixed-race Creole people and their patois and jambalaya. She brought the food and ways with her and spent hours on the roux for her gumbo when things were good. To be reputed to be Creole was enough to make her exotic to some colored people, whether she was actually Creole or not, which no one ever established for sure, but most assumed was true. She was a small woman, with skin the color of chestnuts and wavy black hair. It was said she would have been considered quite a beauty if it weren't for the tight bun she wore low on her head, with the severe center part at her forehead, and the fact that she seemed rarely to smile at anyone other than her children. All of the children were bright, but in the family hierarchy, there was not much Pershing could do to distinguish himself, with one big brother off in medical school and another a star athlete. He played softball with the neighborhood kids, where they used broomsticks for bats, and made their own rules because nobody had seen an official baseball game. But he wasn't especially good at it. Pershing looked for a way to prove himself. There were 3 fig trees in their yard, and he picked the figs and sold them to the neighbors, 35 cents for a gallon bucket. He gave them a broad smile and charmed them into believing they needed the figs for breakfast or for preserves or to can for the coming winter. He practiced smiling in the mirror and writing with his left hand, even though he didn't need to. He lived for the pat on the head from his father, but especially his mother for washing out the wash tub or any little thing that he did. He took to cleaning the house to make them happy and to keep the compliments coming, but it only felt good as long as he did it before they could ask. He was crushed whenever he fell short. His parents punished him by making him go to the back steps and sit there. He sat hugging his dog and cried. Sometimes his mother got tired of him sitting on the steps and called him in. Otherwise, he couldn't leave until his father said so. "All right," Professor Foster would say. "Come back in." It was true he couldn't milk a cow, but he didn't mind churning. He churned the milk as it soured and clabbered. Otty skimmed the butter off, and he proceeded to go door to door, selling the butter and the buttermilk in a lard bucket with a cultivated earnestness and the crisp airs he was beginning to master. "Mrs. Poe, don't you want to buy some milk from me? Can I start bringing you milk on Thursdays?" He found that he could get people to like him, and that if people liked him, he could get what he wanted. For each grade, there was one teacher, and when Pershing got to the seventh grade, Mama taught him. She stood at the front of the room and drilled math and verse into him and the rest of the class without humor or partiality. Sometimes Pershing got restless and leaned over to talk to Moses Potter or Nimrod Sherman or maybe Jimmy Peters. When he did, Otty stopped in the middle of the lesson and glared down hard at him. "Pershing, be quiet." She stood by the blackboard and waited. "Pershing, be quiet." He didn't hear her, engrossed as he was. She marched over to his desk. He felt her shadow looming over him and continued to talk. She raised her left hand and smacked him in front of the class. The other children laughed and laughed. Pershing put his head down and knew not to test Mama anymore. He could get away with less with his mother than with any other teacher in the school. It seemed to him that for every good thing about being the teacher and principal's son, there was a bad thing to it. If he was caught running down the street, somebody would stick her head out the window and remind him who he was. "Boy, get on out the street. I'm a tell Miss Foster on you." To further complicate his life, the Fosters were bookish, small-boned people, and the children of the sawmill hands towered over Pershing. The days when he didn't walk home with Mama, when he was alone on the streets of Newtown, some of the boys lay in wait for him. They surrounded him and taunted him for the way he carried himself and the half-inch of extra privilege he had over them. "You think you somebody 'cause you Fessa Foster's boy. You think you better than anybody else 'cause you a Foster." They made a circle around him and felt bigger because of it. If Professor Foster had whipped the boys with his strap that day, Pershing paid for it that afternoon. They beat him and had a good time doing it. He took it because he had to, and fighting wasn't in him. Telling his father would have made things worse. Professor Foster knew no other way to keep errant children in line and would have beat the boys again if he knew what they'd done to his youngest boy, which would have only made life harder for Pershing. So he kept it to himself. As Pershing got to be a teenager, he started venturing out into the neighborhood, poking his head into the juke joints and the pool hall where the hip cats drank late into the night. It was where the men slapped Woo on the back as they poured him another shot of whiskey. But whenever Pershing poked his head inside, he got the same wave of the hand from the proprietor and the men lining the wall. "Boy, get out of here. You ain't got no business in here. Fessa Foster wouldn't want you in here." Wu wouldn't have minded, and never told him not to come in. But the word had spread somehow that Professor Foster and his wife had a different life in mind for Pershing. There were pressures coming at him from every direction. His high-minded parents, trying to make up in a single generation all that they had been denied through generations of slavery. Bullying kids who taunted him and resented his station, tentative though it was. Neighborhood people watching his every move. Then there were the reminders that no matter what he did or how smart he might be, he would always be seen as inferior to the lowliest person in the ruling caste, which only meant he had to work even harder to prove the system wrong, because it had been drilled into him that he had to be better than the system construed him to be. He lived under the accumulated weight of all these expectations. "People in the town demanded more of us," he said years later, and we had to give it. I respected what they told me, and anything I didn't want them to see, I kept it out of their sight. Every few years, a teacher from Monroe Colored High loaded a band of students onto the flatbed of a pickup truck and rattled across the Missouri Pacific Railway tracks. They passed the rich people's porticos and pulled up to the back entrance of the white high school in town. The boys jumped out and began stacking the truck bed with the books the white school was throwing away. That is how Monroe Colored High School got its books. The boys loaded the truck with old geography and English texts, some without covers and with pages torn out and love notes scrawled in the margins, and headed back to their side of town. By the time he was old enough to understand where the books came from, Pershing was fast putting together the pieces of the world he lived in. He knew there was a dividing line, but it was hitting him in the face now. He was showing a talent for science and was getting to the point that he needed reference books to do his lesson. But it was against the law for colored people to go to the public library. And the library at the colored high school did not live up to its name, he said years later. He was in the eighth grade when word filtered to his side of the tracks that Monroe was getting a new high school. It wouldn't replace the old building that Monroe Colored High was in. It was for the white students, who already had a big school. It would be called Neville High. The colored people could see it going up when they ventured to the other side of the tracks. It rose up like a castle, four stories of brick and concrete, with separate wings and a central tower, looking as if it belonged at Princeton or Yale. It opened in 1931 on 22 acres of land. The city fathers made a fuss over the state-of-the-art laboratories for physics and chemistry, the 2,200-seat balconied auditorium, the expanded library, and the fact that it was costing $664,000 to build. As the new high school took shape across town, Pershing watched his father rise in the black of morning to milk the cows and walk the mile and a half to open his building, the size of a grade school. His father, his mother, and the other teachers at Monroe Colored High School were working long hours with hand-me-down supplies for a fraction of the pay their white counterparts were getting. In Louisiana in the 1930s, white teachers and principals were making an average salary of $1,165 a year. Colored teachers and principals were making $499 a year, 43% of what the white ones were. Pershing's parents could console themselves that they were faring better than colored teachers in other southern states, a reflection not necessarily of their superior performance, but that there were states even worse than Louisiana when it came to teachers' pay. In neighboring Mississippi, white teachers and principals were making $630 a year, while the colored ones were paid a third of that, $215 a year, hardly more than field hands. But knowing that didn't ease the burden of the Fosters' lives, get their children through college, or allow them to build assets to match their status and education. The disparity in pay, reported without apology in the local papers for all to see, would have far-reaching effects. It would mean that even the most promising of colored people, having received next to nothing in material assets from their slave foreparents, had to labor with the knowledge that they were now being underpaid by more than half, that they were so behind it would be all but impossible to accumulate the assets their white counterparts could, and that they would, by definition, have less to leave succeeding generations than similar white families. Multiplied over the generations, it would mean a wealth deficit between the races that would require a miracle windfall or near asceticism on the part of colored families if they were to have any chance of catching up or amassing anything of value. Otherwise, the chasm would continue, as it did for blacks as a group, even into the succeeding century. The layers of accumulated assets built up by the better-paid dominant caste, generation after generation, would factor into a wealth disparity of white Americans having an average net worth 10 times that of black Americans by the turn of the 21st century, dampening the economic prospects of the children and grandchildren of both Jim Crow and the Great Migration before they were even born. For now, each day, Pershing's parents and the families whose children they taught had to live with the reality that they had to do more with less. Southern states made no pretense as to the lopsided division of resources to white and colored schools, devoting as much as $10 per white student for every dollar spent on a colored student, and showing little interest beyond that meager investment. The money allocated to the colored children is spent on the education of the white children, a local school superintendent in Louisiana said bluntly. We have twice as many colored children of school age as we have white, and we use their money. Colored children are mighty profitable to us. When a fire broke out in the basement of Monroe Colored High School, destroying classroom furniture and equipment, the city refused to so much as replace the desks and teaching supplies that had burned to ashes, as the Monroe News Star reported. The tax dollars were earmarked for Neville. The colored parents, already strapped, would have to raise the money themselves. That would be just one more thing weighing on Professor Foster. As it was, he wasn't making half of what the Neville High School principal made. Nobody in Newtown would be allowed in the new building when it opened, other than to clean it, and the idea of Pershing attending it, no matter how smart he was unthinkable. It was not something the Fosters would have wanted to dwell on, as it would have done them no good, but their very existence, their personal aspirations, and the purpose of their days were in direct opposition to the white ruling class policy on colored education. That is, that colored people needed no education to fulfill their God-given role in the South. If these Negroes become doctors and merchants, or buy their own farms, a Southern woman told the celebrated journalist Ray Stannard Baker, what shall we do for servants? The unfairness started to eat at Pershing. It was a curse to be able to see it, better not to know. But the older he got, the more he was starting to want, and the more he wanted, the harder it was to accept that he might never get it, all because of a chemical in his skin that some people resented and felt superior to, and that no one on this earth could change. To make matters worse, he had the misfortune of having developed exquisite taste, and what little he was exposed to only fed his ambitions. Everything you wanted was white, and the best, he said. Pershing had started to notice the girls, and they started to notice him. They were getting to an age where they would walk home from school together, meet at the Paramount for the picture show, and eventually end up in a park or a field somewhere. Somebody would get a car from an uncle or someone or other, and they would drive up to where the new Neville High was, shiny new and perched high on a hill. It was lush and secluded, and when they had finished with the girls, they whirred past the grounds and flung their spent condoms on the green. That's how we showed our resentment, he said years later. Don't think we were blind. Just before dark, when the sky is neither blue nor black but purple, Pershing stepped out of the tin tub to get ready for a Saturday night. He put on long pants and cheap cologne and walked in the direction of the Miller and Roy building on the colored side of Five Points, about a mile from the center of town. It was in the shadow of downtown, in a world of its own. The axis was 18th and Desert. Across from the office building was the drugstore. Behind the drugstore was a cafe. Behind the cafe was a liquor store. Across from the liquor store was the pool hall. He had his shirt buttoned low and open as he strutted down Desert. He was 2 blocks from the Miller and Roy building when a car pulled up to the curb. The exhaust spit and coughed. A white man leaned out of the window. Hey, boy. Pershing kept walking. He hated being called boy, even though he was one. They barked it at the sawmill hands, and it bent over old colored men, and even upstanding men like his father. He was 14, and it was already beginning to grate on him.
"Hey, boy!"
Pershing stopped and consoled himself.
"You can answer him because you are a boy. You're not 21 yet. Technically, you're still a boy. That makes it okay for him to address you as boy."
He turned toward the car and kept it to "yes" instead of "yes, sir."
"Boy, I'll pay you if you get me a nice, clean, colored girl."
Pershing breathed deep. Ever since his sister Gold had hit puberty, he could hardly walk down the street with her without white men with snuff in their mouth yelling out what they would do to her. It made him want to vomit. She kept her head up and held his hand tight and walked through it. He could never defend her, never stand up to a gang of them on a street corner. "That was death," he would say years later. Pershing knew it from the sheer insanity all around him. When he was 11 years old, a white mob burned down the courthouse across the border in Sherman, Texas. It started with a colored man accused of raping a white woman, a confession extracted, a trial hastily set. But just as the trial opened, a mob stormed the courtroom and torched the building to get to the defendant, George Hughes. Court officials fled through a second-story window and left Hughes in a steel vault with a bucket of water. Firefighters tried to save the courthouse, but the mob slashed the water hoses to keep the blaze going. The mob then dynamited the vault where Hughes had been left. The mob found him dead, crushed by the explosion, the water bucket almost empty. The courthouse then burned to the ground. Disappointed that they had not gotten to Hughes before he died, the people in the mob hanged his body from a cottonwood tree and set it on fire with furniture they looted from a nearby colored hotel. Then they torched the colored district as the colored people of Sherman fled to the homes of white friends or left town. A half dozen colored homes escaped the torching only because a white man told the mob the houses belonged to him. This was the world Pershing was growing up in. He had learned the rules early in life. Now he was standing at a vacant curb, just him and a white man out prowling. He had never seen the man before, imagined he must have come in from the country and made a beeline for the colored section with one thing in mind, as was his prerogative. Not just any colored girl. A nice, clean colored girl. The man waited, and Pershing assessed the situation. He was on the colored side of town, a block from the rooming house. He knew every turn and alley. He was in the majority around here. He looked at the man. "A nice, clean, colored girl," he said, calculating the risks of what he might say next. "Let me see. I tell you what, you get your mama for me, and I'll get you one." He didn't wait for the man's reaction. Pershing vanished into the colored alleys of Five Points. He couldn't believe what had come out of his mouth. His face was flushed and his hand shook. He could get hanged for that. Nothing more needed to happen to remind him who had the power over him and what they could do if they wanted. "You lived with it," Pershing said years later. "But it wasn't that you liked the taste of it." And I'd whisper to myself that someday the sun was going to shine down on me, way up north in Chicago or Kansas City or one of those other faraway places that my cousin always talked about. I felt the same restlessness in me. Mahalia Jackson, Moving On Up. The South, 1915 to the 1970s. At Easter and around the 4th of July, the people from the North came. They looked like extras out of a movie at the Saturday matinee. They wore peplums and bergamot waves. Even the wind moved aside as they walked. They flashed thick rolls of cash from their pockets, the biggest bills on the outside covering the ones and fives. They said they were making all kinds of money, but they didn't have to say it because the cars and the clothes did the talking. They'd been wiring more money to their families back home than they truly could spare and had been saving up all year for those gloves and matching purse. But they weren't telling the people in the South that. They made sure to show up at their mother churches, where everyone would see them, at Gethsemane Baptist Church in Eustis, Florida, where little George went, at Thankful Baptist Church in Rome, Georgia, where my mother saw the people visiting from the north, at New Hope Baptist Church in Chickasaw County, Mississippi, where Ida May lived, even at Zion Traveler Baptist Church in Monroe, Louisiana, where Pershing grew up. The partisans set aside their rivalries and sat upright in the pews when the people from the north came. The pastor would ask the visitors to rise, and it was then that the people from up north or out west stood up in their butterfly hats and angel dresses and in suits upholstered to the tall men's frames. People who hadn't seen them in ages now craned their necks to see how Willie and Thelma looked and if they had changed any. And the pastor went on about how this one was building cars in Detroit, and that one was doing us proud in Oakland. They were received like visiting dignitaries. They had once been just like the people who stayed. Now they were doing important-sounding work for the government in Washington, in the hotels on Michigan Avenue in Chicago, in the garment district in New York, or in the apartments of the rich people on Riverside Drive. They wore the protective coating of the North. They lived in big cities, too distracted to care what the colored people did, as long as they did it to themselves, and that was the greatest blessing of all. At night, when the June bugs came out, the children sat at the knees of the people from the North and heard stories of doing unimaginable things, like sitting in the front of a trolley car and saying, "Yes," instead of, "Yes, sir," to a white person, and living to tell it. In Grenada, Mississippi, two little boys couldn't wait for their big sister Francie to come visit from Ohio. Gilbert and Percy Ellie would crouch at her feet and listen to her. "We would sit on the porch in the moonlight," Gilbert remembered, "and she would tell us about the North." Then she went back to Ohio, and life returned to the way it was for Gilbert and Percy, living as they were in the altogether different country of the Mississippi Delta. They and Ida May and George and Pershing and children all over the South were growing up trying to comprehend the caste they were born into, adjusting or resisting, lying in bed at night and imagining a world that was different and free, and knowing it was out there because they had seen it in the casual airs, the haughtiness even, and the clothes and the stories of the people from the North. Now nothing around them made sense, and everything that happened to them imprinted itself into their psyches and loomed larger because they had glimpsed what was possible outside the bars of their own existence. Yet they were too young to escape, so they had to endure their peculiar station in the feudal world they were consigned to, and the madness that could intrude at any given moment. Like the night back in the 1940s, a moon-shining night, bright, like it's almost day, when little Gilbert and Percy were sitting on the front porch steps of their family's cabin. The boys could hear voices coming from the woods. The voices echoed through the trees in the night. The boys got quiet and still and tried to make out what was happening. They could hear the crackle of a whip and a hollow wailing coming from the woods. A colored man was being lashed in the pine scrub beyond their cabin. The boys heard the man cry out with each blow. "All right, we gonna take a break," some voices finally said. There was silence. Then the men took up the task again. "We gonna kill you," the voices said from the woods. "Please, please don't," the colored voice said. "Before y'all do, will you let me pray?" The man began to pray.
The man prayed a prayer like a Baptist preacher, Gilbert remembered decades later.
I ain't never heard a man pray like that man.
Father, forgive them, for they know not what they doin'.
Gilbert remembered the man praying.
I lived a good life for you. If you never done nothing for me, Lord, please.
All right, that's enough, the other voices said.
The man continued to pray. The beating and wailing commenced again. Then the wailing stopped.
The son of a bitch did,
came a voice from the woods. Gilbert could never get the man's cries out of his head.
We don't know who he was,
Gilbert said some 50 years later,
or what he was supposed to have done.
The seeds of Gilbert's departure from Mississippi were sown that night. More seeds were planted another day, when he and his father and brother were walking home from the movie theater in town. The street was little more than an alley, barely wide enough for two people to walk astride. Gilbert was about 12. He was reading a comic book and not paying attention. Three white boys, not much older than Gilbert, came in their direction. Gilbert's father and brother instinctively jumped out of the way. Gilbert was looking at his comic book and bumped into one of the boys. The boy grabbed Gilbert by the collar.
Who do you think you are?
Gilbert remembered the boy asking him. The boy spat at him, and Gilbert hit the boy back. Gilbert's father was shaking with fear. He begged forgiveness from the boy who spat on his son. Then he turned to his son and upbraided him.
Boy, what's the matter with you? His father said. Are you crazy?
The father fumed at him.
All the way home, he didn't talk to me, Gilbert remembered decades later. I got home, he didn't say a word.
That night, Gilbert could hear his father confiding to his mother through the cardboard-thin walls of their cabin.
Sugar, that one son we got, Gilbert, I'm afraid for him,
the father whispered.
That boy'll never live if he stays in Grenada.
Gilbert knew that. He shared his dreams with Percy when they worked in the field, hoeing and plowing and weighing up the cotton.
We would plow side to side, Gilbert remembered. He'd have a row and I'd have a row. We would talk. We would talk about school or what I'm going to do when I get to be grown when I leave here.
His big sister's stories of life up north had seeped into him. And one day, when he got big enough, he told himself he was going to follow her to Ohio. And he did. Hundreds of miles away, out in the country near Jackson, North Carolina, a family named DeBrow was in a tizzy whenever Cousin Beulah was expected in from New York. The mother cooked all day. The daughters, Virginia and Lee, cleaned and swept and tried to imagine how she would look. It was as if the Queen of England were coming. Beulah blew into town in the latest silk dresses, her high heels click-clacking on the pavement. Her hair was pressed and shiny and swung when she turned her head. The girls touched it to see how it felt.
If we could just look like that, Virginia told her sister.
Virginia started dreaming then and there. Someday I'm going to New York. She sat and planned the whole thing out with her little brother. She wouldn't have to pick cotton anymore or feel the spike of frost on the wet grass going barefoot to the outhouse in the morning. In the early 1940s, she did in fact join the multitudes. The day she left, her mother made fried chicken and broke down crying. Her father was too hurt to speak. He stayed in the house as they left.
He did not bid us goodbye, she said.
She ended up in Brooklyn, where the elevated train shook the apartment and looked as if it were coming straight into the window, and where she would get her hair pressed and wear high heels click-clacking on the pavement like Beulah. Sometimes the young people had little choice but to leave sooner than they had imagined. Such was the case with my mother's older brother. He was a teenager in Rome, Georgia, working as a driver and office boy for an upstanding white man in town during the Depression. He would drive the man from Georgia to Miami for the man's business trips, alone with him in the car for hours at a time. He liked the man because he let him keep the big new shiny